On education will come to order. Ladies and gentlemen, guests, thank you very much for being here. As some of you may know from having attended our Friday session, we will begin as promptly as possible at our appointed starting time. And we have, along with some other committees, as I understand, in the building, have an education fund, and the fund will be supported by use of acronyms, and I would request that for our edification that you, as much as possible, give us the full definitive phraseology for whatever acronym you might be using, at least the first go through, and then feel free to use the reference of the acronym as you go through your testimony. And secondly, cell phones. If they ring, I think we're charging a premium today at $5 per ring. But there is a dollar fine for the acronym usage, and we'll be creative in how we fund others. Now, I will also put you on alert. Representative March is very creative and very supportive of education, and he will be calling through the lobby book to see if your cell phones are on. Okay. So, you have been so noticed. We're here today to continue our journey as we look for the golden opportunities carefully disguised as unresolved problems in the areas of education. And we are very honored today to have representatives from the Oregon Department of Education, also ODE, here to give us an overview, background on their reorganization. So, Superintendent Castillo, we're very, very honored to have you with us. Vicki Fleming as well. And Pat Burke, thank you very much. So, I don't know if the three-chair situation will work. So,
they're still all connected.
They're still all connected. So,
mind us crawling on the floor. Okay.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Castillo, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. And I am very happy to be here before this committee. I want to just say happy Martin Luther King birthday. We know that Dr. King was very focused on creating success for all children in this country, and that is absolutely the work of the department and of our schools today in the State of Oregon. So thank you for this opportunity to be with you today. We at the department hope to have a very collaborative relationship with the legislature and to provide any assistance and information that we can to you, so please do not hesitate to call on us for information testimony or whatever you need from us this legislative session. We are at your service. I've provided you with this year's annual state report card. It is a great resource to answer many of the questions about our schools and about education in Oregon today. And it's also a report that's available on our website. For the last few years, we all know that it has been challenging for educators in the state of Oregon. While budgets have declined, our expectations have remained high both in our state and by the federal government. The good news is that Oregon students were a close second in the nation with their scholastic aptitude test scores, otherwise known as SAT, and performed better than 45 other states on the American College Testing Test, the ACT test. Oregon's dropout rate continues to decline, and more students graduated and attended college than ever before. And the greatest education challenge Oregon faces is eliminating the gap in achievement between high-performing students and students challenged by language, disability, and poverty. When I took office 2 years ago, I brought in business leaders to review the department's structure, focus, and business practices. And as a result of this review, the department was reorganized last April. And the new structure streamlines the department and improves internal communications and service delivery. With the reorganization, accountability is now the central function of the Department of Education. We're working on developing a more comprehensive accountability system that will provide the public and our educators with timely and accurate information. Last year, I announced six priorities for the department. First, we want to help children be ready for first grade. And to this end, we're helping districts in the design of their kindergarten programs and helping them with possible sources of funding, such as the federal funds that they receive. Secondly, we want to close the achievement gap and have all students be successful. We've provided statewide training and resources to teachers and administrators on No Child Left Behind requirements, as well as strategies to close the achievement gap. We're working on assessing individual student growth from year to year, so we'll know if every student is progressing at an expected rate, whether they are talented and gifted students or students with disabilities. Literacy remains a priority. We've worked with hundreds of educators to be better reading teachers by training them to identify early reading difficulties and intervene before young readers become frustrated and turn away from reading. The department has been awarded a second round of federal Reading First grants. Oregon is set to receive over $7 million each year for the next 5 years, and these grants are targeted to the schools that need the most help. School and district leadership is critical in the success of students. We know that. And through the department's efforts, the Wallace Foundation has awarded the state of Oregon $700,000 to strengthen education leadership in the areas of cultural competency and K-12 literacy. The department supports making every school a community school. Last year, the department received $4.2 million of federal funds as part of the No Child Left Behind Act to fund new academic and enrichment programs during out-of-school time and education and family literacy opportunities for the participating children's adult family members. And we expect additional funds this year to continue that effort. The need to improve middle and high schools is urgent. We all know that. Test scores show that Oregon's high school students continue to struggle. Only one in three high schools met the federal standard, and fewer than 15% were rated strong or exceptional on the report card. So we're working on making high school more meaningful to students by requiring schools to develop an education plan for each student and expanding opportunities to earn college credit. And before I conclude my remarks, I'd like to say something about state funding. A school budget of $5 billion as currently proposed will result in additional cuts in school programs. There is no doubt about it. And I believe that Oregonians, I know that Oregonians care very much about the quality of their schools and don't want to see more programs cut and a shortened school year due to lack of funding. We at the department are committed to student success, and I hope that we can work together to support Oregon by supporting our local schools. We welcome your suggestions on improving the accountability of schools, districts, education service districts, and, of course, the Department of Education. And I'd like to now turn the microphone over to two members of my team, Vicki Fleming, who is the deputy superintendent at the department, who will describe the department's mission, our recent reorganization, and our work with education service districts. And then Pat Burke, my chief policy officer, will talk at greater length about our focus on accountability. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Vicki Fleming, deputy superintendent, Oregon Department of Education. It's very nice to be with you this afternoon, and I'm pleased to give you a very brief, high-level overview of the Oregon Department. I assume since the chair referred to ODE that will be an acceptable acronym to use from here on out. Just want to check. I don't want to make sure I brought enough money.
Okay.
All right. So this overview will obviously set the stage for a more in-depth exploration of additional education and related issues in the coming weeks. The intent today is just to provide you with a snapshot of the responsibilities of the department and answer any questions you might have. The statutory responsibility of the Oregon Department of Education is to oversee a system of standard public schools, kindergarten through 12th grade, for Oregon's 198 school districts and 20 education service districts. And as you know, currently there are nearly 600,000 students going to school each day in Oregon. Just for the sake of that snapshot I mentioned, the general fund amount proposed in the governor's recommended budget is right around $36 million. We have, on any given day, right around 250 people that work at the Oregon Department of Education, in addition to another 200 that work at the schools for the blind, deaf, and in our youth corrections education program. And for the sake of context, 250 bodies, actual full-time equivalencies in the department, is about the same number of people employed by Reynolds High School, including their faculty and staff. So that gives you a little bit of context. We have, as the superintendent mentioned, faced doing more with less, as have schools over the last several biennium. If you look back to the 99-01 legislative approved budget, over the course of those years, the percentage change of the investment in the department's operational budget is a reduction of about 18%. The mission of the agency is to provide leadership for an effective, accountable, and comprehensive education enterprise in Oregon. Enterprise is a word that you'll hear us talking about a lot in terms of the way we are doing business with education service districts, community colleges, and universities. We don't think of just the K-12 system in our work any longer. At the start of the 2003 legislative session, the superintendent laid out a list of priorities that you just heard about, including a well-run, efficient, and accountable Oregon Department of Education. We outlined a set of ambitious goals, not the least of which was reorganizing and improving the department to be more focused on results. The planning that went into this reorganization started about 2 years ago, and it's been in place for approximately a year. I've been in this position for about 6 months officially, as has Pat. There's only one manager who was there in the previous administration, and we all have different jobs than we had when we started. So lots of change. It was designed, the reorg was designed to address the changing dynamics in both Oregon and at the federal level. Specifically, in a post-Measure 5 environment, the Oregon educational system has moved from one that was, as you know, locally funded to one that is now largely state-funded. In other words, more responsibility for the education of Oregon's children has been shifted from the local property tax to state income tax. Once less visible in the distribution of state school support money, the department has now become a critical tool for the management and accountability of those dollars that the state spends on public education. In addition, the expectations surrounding student achievement continue to grow. Susan mentioned this. The federal No Child Left Behind Act has provided an additional focus on accountability with increased requirements for collecting and analyzing data on individual students as opposed to what we've done in the past, which is really to aggregate results with schools and districts. In other words, the Oregon Department of Education, and in many ways the entire Oregon education system, is in transition, attempting to meet ever-increasing expectations in an era of financial constraints. Faced with the new realities and guided by the goals of accountability, leadership, and school improvement, the department managers developed this plan to reorganize, to break down silos, work across disciplines, and become a full partner with higher education and community colleges in assuring that every Oregonian has access to a quality education. I want to refer you now to the organizational chart that hopefully you have in front of you. It looks like this. It's two-sided. Shows you what the department structure looked like in January of 2001 and, in fact, what it looks like today. I'm just going to go through this briefly and explain to you what the new offices are intended to accomplish. We've streamlined our management structure, hopefully, as I mentioned, creating one that is more cooperative and integrated. We have fewer managers, so it's easier to have better communication and to discuss the goals of the superintendent and the enterprise on a regular basis. The emphasis on the management of state and federal programs has shifted to what are the critical functions of the education system and, as I said, to performance management. The names of the offices are intended to reflect those critical functions. First, let me talk about the largest of our offices, Educational Improvement and Innovation, which is what we would hope for the system. This office is responsible for implementing Oregon's Educational Act, development of academic content standards, management of federal programs, and professional technical education. Those functions are now combined into one office as opposed to what existed before, which was three separate offices. That resulted in, for example, the development of the Certificate of Initial Mastery, being done in one office and the development of the Certificate of Advanced Mastery being done in another office. This caused some confusion and some philosophical tension, if you will, and the combining of those offices really has resulted in better thinking and better future ways of doing business for both the department and the field. By the way, the combining of those three offices has resulted in a transition from 13 executive managers down to 6. The Office of Student Learning and Partnerships is responsible primarily for managing and overseeing direct services for children, such as early childhood, Oregon pre-kindergarten, our youth corrections education, hospital programs, and programs for special needs children. This office is responsible for the development of interagency and community partnerships, and we have been very aggressive about pursuing partnerships with the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, Department of Human Services, government-to-government groups, and as Susan mentioned, this has to happen in order to really accommodate initiatives like the Community Schools Initiative. Our Healthy Kids Learn Better grant from the Centers for Disease Control is very much connected to what work goes on in the community. And we have, under Susan's leadership, instituted an Indian education plan that is intended to inform both the agency and the field about strategies for that population of young people. The Office of System Accountability and Policy Development is a new office and obviously probably one of the most important functions that the department provides currently. As I mentioned, data collection and analysis has become a major aspect of the department's work. The responsibility for oversight of this work now resides in one place rather than having it spread throughout the agency. As you can imagine, the department receives hundreds of requests for information, and in the past those were largely, and still are to some extent, based on people's relationships. Who can you call to get information? Which has resulted in what I would describe as breaking the back of the agency, and we have to be able to prioritize and respond to those requests in a more disciplined way. And this office was created to accommodate that and to help us with our data as it relates to the policy work of the agency and the State Board of Education. The Office of Assessment and Information Services, previously there was an Office of Assessment and Evaluation and a Technology Unit. This office combines those two functions as they are connected at the hip, if you will. Much of the agency's energy, as I said again, is being directed toward collecting and analyzing data. We recognize also the critical importance of direct technical assistance to local schools and districts for teaching and learning, and I'll speak in a moment to how the department can leverage Education Service District resources to deliver those. But we really look forward to an opportunity to have a frank and honest discussion with you about the complex technical environment of our assessment system and some of the challenges that we're facing with that, and that will be something we look forward to soon. And last, the Office of Finance and Administration, responsible for both the management of the agency operation and the management of the state school fund. These changes in this office have included accommodating things like the implementation of a centralized procurement process. We've improved the development and awarding of contracts. We've automated our grants management system for the entire agency. And most recently, created more accountability when it comes to how local districts are spending state school support funds. A few other actions that we've taken to improve the agency's effectiveness very quickly. We've hired an internal auditor to assist with the analysis of risk and business processes. I believe the department is now one of the few state agencies to post the summaries of our internal audits on our public website. We have attempted to work aggressively to eliminate redundant data collections. We have heard a lot of hue and cry from our local districts saying, you're killing us with all this information that you need. And so we work very hard internally to not ask for things twice, and we still have much work to do on that score. We've also worked in collaboration with education service districts to establish a memorandum of understanding that defines the relationship more clearly and the transactions that go between the department and that network of education service districts, and are receiving those signed and approved by local boards as we speak. Just want to close with a little bit about education service districts. our reorganization was really predicated on that idea that we can no longer be all things to all people due to the increased workload of No Child Left Behind and the focus on accountability and performance management. And that has left us in a bit of with a bit of a challenge, and that is, how do we continue to deliver technical assistance and support for school improvement, particularly the aspects of teaching and learning that schools know that they need assistance with in the current climate. And we have looked to this renewed, reinvented partnership with ESDs to accommodate that. We have spoken with Chair Flores and hope and look forward to speaking with you in the future about a proposal that is being developed. We are abundantly clear that there are many ideas that in the legislative process that people have about ESDs. We are working with them to create a proposal that works for the department and hopefully for that network of education service districts, and we hope that you'll be willing to hear that proposal when it's forthcoming. What I can tell you in closing is that the management structure and new tools are in place to deal with the new realities of the education system in Oregon. And as these changes mature and are refined, I believe that they'll pay huge dividends for the state, for local districts, for parents, and for students. And we look forward to working with you through the session to hear your ideas as well. Thank you. Pat Berg, Chief Policy Officer for the Oregon Department.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer for the department. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon, and also look forward throughout the session to working with you in whatever services we can provide. What I would like to do is briefly place within some context where we are with accountability. As State Superintendent Castillo has mentioned, accountability has become a central focus of our agency. And I'd like to give you a little bit of background about how we got to this point and what some of the issues facing us currently are. Education in Oregon is actually located in the Oregon Constitution in 1859. The legislative body was directed under the Constitution to provide a system of uniform and general system of common schools. So from that time forward, the focus has been basically on providing schools. And that has been done through empowering at first county superintendents to define local school districts and to collect taxes and to provide schools, and then later to local school districts to do the same thing. Oregon voters added in 1922 the provision that public education should be universal and had mandatory attendance. But the process was the same, that it was basically delegated to local districts to provide schools. The peak or high watermark of that was 1939, when Oregon had 2,100 school districts. Each town, each local municipality within a county was authorized under Oregon law to collect taxes and to provide common schools. That basic process of providing schools continued actually until the very recent past. And that's where I would like to focus, because in the past 10 to 12 years, significant changes in that process have occurred, and that brings us to where we are currently. Let me start first with May of 1990 and the passage of Ballot Measure 5. And that was, of course, quickly followed by the equalization law. So those two things reversed the balance of funding for states from, as Vicki has mentioned earlier, from basically local funding with a small amount of state funding, that reversed to primary funding through the state with a small amount of local funding, plus the creation of a formula that would distribute those state funds on a fairly equitable per capita basis to all of the school districts in Oregon. a lot going on during that time, of course, not the least of which is reorganization of the state. We've gone from 2,100 school districts to the current 199. So there's been a lot of consolidation over that period of time. The second major change was in July of 1991. The Oregon legislature passed House Bill 3565, better known as the Oregon Educational Act for the 21st Century. And this represented a very significant change for the legislature. Instead of a system of providing schools, the legislature said, what are we getting for our money? What are the outcomes? What do we know of the student performance that we are getting from our investment? And it created a way of measuring that. The legislation created two types of outcomes. One were called core applications for living. The other were called foundation skills. And the department was directed to create a procedure to gather evidence to see if students were learning those skills. And the law created a way of certifying that. And the body of evidence to be collected would rise to a level of proficiency that allowed a certificate to be given to a student who demonstrated those outcomes. Those were called the certificates of initial mastery and the certificate of advanced mastery. And that continued for about 4 years. But by the 1995 session, the legislature was unhappy, as the general public was unhappy, that the outcomes as they were defined seemed vague, very difficult to measure, and very hard to compare from school to school. So the legislature directed the department to go back to the drawing board and to create specific academic content standards in English language arts, mathematics, science, social science, the fine and performing arts, and second languages, six areas. The legislature also directed the department to create performance measures for that. So, if you will, the content is the what do you want students to learn, and the performance is how well do you want them to demonstrate it. And that became part of the system as we have it today, and the legislature directed the department to create measures for those things, and that became the Oregon State Assessment System that you are familiar with. So the system as we currently have it has been around since about 1996, of a statement of content, a statement of proficiency, and measures of that proficiency. Now that continued, that, if you will, was what do we want students to be able to know and how will we know they know it? Then the next question that the legislature tackled was how will we know that the schools are doing a good job? And that became in the 1997 session the Oregon Report Card. The legislature directed the agency, our agency, to develop and implement a method of collecting information on all of Oregon schools and to rate Oregon schools on a 5-point scale from exemplary to unsatisfactory, and to report that information annually by January 30th, and to ensure that that information was placed into the hands of every parent no later than March 31st of each year. That's the Oregon Report Card, and actually was, in many ways, if you look at what was happening in other states around the United States, was kind of ahead of the curve in terms of what states were doing around accountability. That format continued until the next really basic and fundamental change in accountability occurred on January 8th of 2002. That was the date that President Bush signed the No Child Left Behind Act. Now, the No Child Left Behind Act is actually a reauthorization of a very old law. It goes all the way back to when Lyndon Johnson was president. And the Elementary and Secondary Education Act was first passed in 1965. That law must be reauthorized every 6 years by Congress. And on occasion, when it's reauthorized, changes are made and it's given a new name. When President Clinton was president, it was called the Improving America Schools Act, or IASA. Under President Bush, it is now called the No Child Left Behind Act. That law, however, did make some basic changes in this accountability structure, and that has led us to the point where we are right now. So let me explain briefly. Both the state accountability system and the federal accountability system look at the same general topics, but it looks at them differently. For example, both systems require us to calculate how many kids were tested in the system. The federal law requires that number must be over 95% of all eligible students. The Oregon report card looks at a range of performance from about 83% up to 95%. Both systems require us to look at academic achievement. But again, there are important differences. The Oregon report card looks at academic achievement for the entire school on average. It also looks at that achievement over a four-year period of time. And it also looks at whether or not students at all different levels of performance, from very low to very high, are making progress. The No Child Left Behind Act looks at academic achievement in a very different way. It establishes a single threshold, and that threshold must escalate every 3 years toward 2014, when 100% of students are expected to meet state standards. So in the federal system, you have one line, and you're either above the line or not. Whereas in the Oregon system, you're looking at growth over time and school-wide averages. Secondly, the federal system makes a very important departure from the Oregon system by requiring that student achievement at every school be broken down into groups, not just the average. So it also asks, are students for whom English is their second language doing well? Are students with disabilities doing well? Are students of different ethnicities and races doing well? And that information must also be collected and reported publicly. Third, and this is also a major area of difference, the Oregon report card, in our opinion, does an excellent job of looking at growth. The Oregon report card calculates for every school 4 years of information and looks at a two-year average compared to a two-year average to see if schools over time are increasing student achievement. The federal system specifically prohibits this. The only place that growth in the federal system comes into play is if a school has failed the initial measure. They can then show that the students not meeting the state standards has decreased by 10%. That has a euphemism, Madam Chair. I apologize for using it, but you'll probably hear it over the years. That's called safe harbor, and you may hear that term periodically. That means that a school has failed one measure, but it can be seen as meeting if it shows a reduction by 10%. But those are two very different components between the state system and the federal system. And finally, both systems say that they look at behavior, but actually what both systems do is they look at dropout rates and attendance. However, here again, there are differences. The state system looks at a one-year number called the one-year dropout figure. The federal system uses a method established by the National Center for Educational Statistics, and it's the four-year graduation rate. So we have two different measures of very similar concepts. So where does that leave us? What our feeling is, what we have embarked on for the last year and a half, is that this creates confusion in the public. How can, for example, a school be exemplary on the state report card and not be making progress on the federal system? And that happens a lot, and it's confusing the public. We spend a lot of time trying to explain the system, and we know that this is causing a problem. Second, for policymakers such as yourself and for superintendents and principals, it's very hard in that system to know, where do I put my next dollar? How do I focus if I'm getting this kind of different information? So I have provided for you a one-page, two-column handout that outlines for you what we are trying to do to resolve this problem in accountability. Let me briefly walk you through it. What we have embarked upon is a two-phase process that we are already heavily into. And what we've tried to do is look at this from a comprehensive framework. What would we do in accountability to ensure that all schools in Oregon are making progress? The first is that we would look at the quality of the planning that is done initially by districts and by schools. So we are developing and implementing a new process that we call the Continuous Improvement Planning and Accountability Model. Previously, school districts had to give us 3 or 4 different planning documents. State law requires that they submit a district plan. Federal law requires that they submit a federal spending plan for any federal dollars that they receive. They also submit a separate plan for any career or professional technical funds that they receive. And then there's a 4th plan for special education. That's a lot of redundancy and a lot of inefficiency in the system. We've taken that and compressed it into a single plan and merged the planning process with the financial allocation process. Second, we've developed better technology to look at the financial information in the system so that when the state distribution formula for the state school fund is a weighted formula. An obvious question is, where did the money go and what results did we get for those dollars? We've developed and are continuing to work on refinements of ways that we can ask that question. Our technology has greatly improved, particularly the implementation of something called the Secured Student Identifier. Now, Madam Chair, you may hear people come up before your committee. They will refer to that as SSID. All it simply means is that every student in our system has an individual number that identifies them no matter where they are in the system. We have not had that technology prior to this past year and a half. That lets us ask a lot of very good questions about where did the money go, did it go to the students who were eligible to receive it, and what results did we get for that. The next part of the process is to integrate these two report card systems. This will be hard work. We have not only the technical problems to solve of how to integrate these measures, but we will also have to negotiate some of this with the U.S. Department of Education. But we are absolutely convinced that we should add to the Oregon report card this looking at group data, not just the average data, but we are also equally convinced that the federal system is flawed by not looking at student growth over time. And we want to integrate these into a common, more understandable, and more usable system. And finally, we need to look at the system of rewards and consequences. In the Oregon system, what we have is if a school is low or unsatisfactory, they have to submit a revised school improvement plan. If they're found to be a substandard district for 2 consecutive years, the law says that we're supposed to withhold their state school fund. So from a planning point of view, it's a somewhat marginal system where you're either asking somebody to revise their plan or taking all their money away. There's nothing in the middle that focuses on growth and improvement over time, data analysis, and so on. We think that needs to be fixed. Likewise, however, we think that the federal system, that if you are not making progress for 2 years, the first requirement is that you have to offer students the right to transfer to another school or to provide supplemental services or after-school or summer services. There's nothing in that model either that focuses on school improvement over time. And then the biggest problem for superintendents and principals is that the consequences in the federal law only apply to schools that receive federal dollars. So there are a lot of schools in our state that don't receive those federal dollars, and the consequences don't apply. This causes a lot of confusion for policymakers and superintendents, and those are the parts that we would like to fix. So that's where we are with accountability. I look forward to sharing more with you over the coming session. It's an exciting time, but I think we have identified some of the flaws in both systems that I think we can fix and create a more balanced, a more accurate, and a more fair system of accountability in the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you. If you are ready, we'll open it up to questions then from the committee members. Were you chomping at the bit, Representative Dahl?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Well, then please lead.
I'm wondering where the chairman has that bit. You talked about rewards and consequences. In Oregon, the final consequence is the withholding of state funding. Has that ever been done?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, no, to our knowledge, it has not. We came close 2 years ago. We had a number of districts that had, because of budget restraints, provided less than the 990 hours of instruction that is required under Oregon administrative rule. I should say at the outset, these rules are contained within Division 22 of Oregon Administrative Rule. They're sometimes known as the compliance standards. Where we came close was that if those districts had had to go into a third year of providing less than a standard school year, we either would have had to have those districts request a waiver. And if you recall, some of you may recall, the Oregon legislature in the last session approved a bill that allows the state superintendent to grant a third-year waiver under certain circumstances. As it turned out, we did not have any districts that went into that third year, so we, in effect, dodged a bullet. We did not have to make that decision. So other than that, I am not aware of any case where state school fund was specifically withheld for not meeting standard.
Madam Chairman, a follow-up question.
Follow-up.
In your memory, has there ever been state funds withheld from a school for non-compliance or performance?
There have been contractual issues on occasion where funds were withheld pending the resolution of a problem, but as a general course of accountability, we have not withheld state school funds, to my knowledge.
If I may, another question. Yes, a different question. We talked, Susan, about $5 billion in the education budget. Or maybe I guess this would be a tap. One would be concerning. When it was all said and done in the last biennium, how much money was distributed to schools in the general school fund?
It was 4.9
billion. Mm-hmm. That's, Madam Chair, Representative Gollum, that's state general fund money that does not account for either county revenue or local option funds or federal funds. There are a variety of other funds that were distributed.
Follow-up. How many schools are eligible for No Child Left Behind money? What percentage of them?
It's a very good question. I'd have to research that specifically. There are funds available to about 92% of every district in the state. The funds go to districts, and then the districts distribute them to schools within their district. So there's some variance from school to school in terms of the total, or district to district, excuse me, total percentages. What I can provide for you is a list of all of the schools in the state that receive Title I resources by district. We have that information, and I'll be happy to provide it for you.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that as well.
One question.
And if you would provide that through Mr. Keller.
Representative Flores and Representative Dahlem, I do believe, though, that it is about 44-45% of our schools are identified as Title I schools and would be eligible for federal dollars.
Thank you for the ballpark, and then we'll look forward to the report. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Concerning the school equalization, the funding, I come to understand that Multnomah County got the ITACs. They got more money than any other district, and 70% of the ITACs distributed to each school district. So concerning the principle of equalization, it is not equal. How do you compromise that the law mandates equalization of the fund. At the same time, some district has more money because of the local tax. How do you compromise that law from the standpoint of education analysis?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, that is the question of the day in the state of Oregon. You know, we did a lot of work over the last decade on moving us forward on equalization of funding for schools, and as we were implementing No Child Left Behind, and a lot of what happened during that time was taking from Peter to pay Paul, taking from some districts that had higher levels of support and giving it to lower supported districts. In that process, there were a lot of cuts in those higher performing districts. And now here we are again with the situation where the base level of support that comes from the state is not adequate, and so in parts of our state, communities step forward and say, we're going to take this to our voters in our communities, and we're going to ask them if they'll step up and provide additional funding so that we don't have to lay off more teachers or cut more programs or have shorter school years. And so we have a number of communities that have stepped forward to do that, and some have been successful and some have not. And you know, under current law, there are very limited opportunities for communities to do that, but there are some. And so what we do have in the state of Oregon is parts of our state where that is just not possible. Communities don't have the resources, and it would be difficult for them to provide more local support for their schools, and then we have other parts of the state where people are able to do that. And as I travel around the state, there is great disparity right now on what's happening with levels of programs and the struggles with our schools. There are some districts where they're very struggling to keep the doors open for a full school year, and there are others that still have a wide array and of program opportunities for their students, which is terrific. So that is the question for us, is how do we do this better and provide equal opportunity for all students to get the program that they need to get in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Another question?
Okay.
Yes. Concerning the dropout rates mentioned, the dropout rate is going down. As I read it, it's about 4% a year, or a little more than 4%. It used to be more than 5%.
Correct.
I'm wondering, do you use the same method of calculation or a different method to come up with a lower number? And sometimes a number counted twice, so it could be higher. I'm wondering, do you have a different approach, a different formula of calculating the dropout rate? How do you do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, it's a very insightful question. There are two methods, and both methods generate slightly different numbers. The number that you are referring to is a one-year dropout rate, and that number is down around 4.5%. It's the lowest it's been in about 10 years. But you have to specify what is the question that lies behind that answer. And the question there is, of the students who began the school year this year, how many of those school students are still in enrollment at the end of the school year? And that number is calculated as a dropout rate. The methodology that is used by the National Center for Educational Statistics asks a very different question, so you get a different number. It says, of students who began in a cohort of students 4 years prior, how many of those ninth graders 4 years later graduate with a standard high school diploma? I just said a mouthful. Let me distinguish between a standard high school diploma and, for example, a student with learning disabilities or other types of disabilities that would prohibit them from achieving a full standard diploma. That diploma is known as a modified diploma, where the student may still earn all of the required units of credit, but the level of that credit may not be the equivalent of a standard high school diploma. Those students are removed from that number. Students who complete high school in a community college high school completion program are removed from the number. Students who leave high school early and go on to university, and we have some students who do that, are removed from the number. Students who don't fit that category of 4 years standard high school diploma. We also have students who return to high school for a fifth year or a sixth year in order to earn a standard high school diploma. They are removed from the number. So that number is actually closer to about 68.9% of all ninth graders leaving high school 4 years later with a standard high school diploma. So your question is absolutely correct. They are different numbers used for different purposes, and so we have to specify what's the question behind the number.
Exactly. So may I just comment, Mr. Chair? So actual dropout rate might not be different from the 2-3 years ago, only the way of calculating it makes it lower. Is that a correct assessment?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, I would disagree with that. Both numbers do seem to be improving over time. Either way you calculate it, we do seem to be holding more kids in school toward graduation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My colleague, Ms. Fleming, just pointed out those numbers are on page 31 of the state report card that you've been given.
Representative Fleming.
Pat, when you remove all of the groups that you listed as removed, intact group, then we've lost 31% of our students?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I wouldn't say that we've lost them. Of the total number of students that we can't account for are the students who seem to have simply stopped going to school. That number is right around 7%, as I recall. It's high.
Is that annually or is that the intact group?
That's the intact group over 4 years. So that's a high number. I personally don't want to see any student leave our school without getting a diploma. But the other options that are available to students, like community colleges and other types of programs, do continue to keep kids in school and to have students moving forward toward graduation. There is a number in that four-year cohort that does concern us, and we've talked about it a lot, and you heard the superintendent talk about our high school reform initiative. Somewhere around 5.5%, I don't have the numbers in front of me, of students indicate that they attended school for 4 years but didn't get a diploma. Now, that, Representative Lim, is a different number. Those students are not dropouts. They continued to come to school on a regular basis, but they didn't earn enough credits to graduate within 4 years. That may be a reflection of not engaging adequately with the school and not accumulating credit on an annual basis over that four-year period of time sufficient to graduate on time. And that's a population that we're very concerned about.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman. You talked about community colleges and universities to some extent, I guess. How does the funding travel? Let's take one of those 7% that are lost in the shuffle. Or I imagine there's some percent, 3 or 4, that go 4 years and don't get a diploma. When they go into the community college system or the university system, how does the money travel?
If they are still registered, Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, if they're still registered in both institutions count the student in their FTE, so that the community college counts the student, the high school is still counting the student. If the student has withdrawn from the high school, actually removed themselves from the high school and registered in the community college, then that student is no longer counted in the average daily membership of the high school. So there's some opportunity for some of our students, actually a growing number of our students, have taken what are called dual enrollment types of courses, both in the high school and the community college.
I'm at the other end of this spectrum where that probably wouldn't happen, but could, I'm sure, where we have someone that has left school, we'll make him 16. Is there any public school money transferred to the community college for educating that child?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, my former job before coming to the department was to manage the consortium that worked with 32 high schools in this region between the high school and the community college. There were several examples of districts working with the local outreach centers for the community college to pay the tuition, actually to have that student that was enrolled in their district receive their education at the community college outreach center and not actually attend at the local high school. We've recently put together a range of all of the different innovations and ways that that districts, high schools, are interacting with community colleges and universities, and we'll be happy to bring that over and have you take a look at it, because there are many creative ways that districts are brokering better options for their students as a result of that.
Thank you. Would appreciate that as well. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where do students getting a GED, where do they fall in these statistics?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, if you refer to page 33 of the state report card, rather than depending on my memory to recall all of these, let me refer you to the most recent information.
Let's see, great.
Students, about 3.7% of the students who began high school in ninth grade earn a GED. And for purposes of this statistic, they are not counted in that four-year graduation rate. They are counted separately. And let me correct, Madam Chair, now that I have the numbers in front of me, my answer to Representative Lim's question, the number of students not completing is 17.4. I believe I said 7. I'd like to correct that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. Ms. Burke, you had, when we were talking about the federal fund component, you said there were a lot of schools who did not receive their federal dollars. And how many are a lot of schools? Do we have numbers on that?
We do. I don't recall them off the top of my head, Madam Chair. I'll be happy to get that for you.
Thank you.
There are 1,250 schools in the state, approximately, and as the superintendent indicated, about a little less than half of those schools receive federal dollars. So, but I'll get you the exact number.
Okay. And then also in regard to No Child Left Behind and the funding that is tied to that, that is an optional component. I mean, if some school wanted to say, I don't want to participate, they could opt not to receive those funds. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. The way federal funds work, states apply to the U.S. Department of Education. They submit a plan based upon the number of students eligible within the state that meet the poverty guidelines, and that is normally a census tract calculation. The state then has the responsibility of receiving application from districts that meet the same criteria. It's based on the percent of students meeting poverty guidelines. However, when the funds are allocated to the district has some flexibility in terms of the schools that actually receive the funds. At that point, schools must achieve or must have a 35% or higher free and reduced price lunch percentage to be eligible for the federal dollars. So there, even though the district receives the money, not every school receives money. Then within that framework as well, school districts can choose to target money to certain eligible schools. For example, they could put more money in elementary schools than they do in high schools. Even though the school might be technically eligible, the local district has some flexibility in terms of where the money actually goes.
You. And then I'm not sure, if, Superintendent, if this is for you or Ms. Fleming, but it's my recollection that during the interim when you had provided us a similar right organization chart, there was some comment made about the prior superintendent's notation of the various FTEs as they flow through. And I think that I recall that we were asking for something similar to that, and I notice we don't have that yet. Do you have numbers that can plug into the various levels here?
Madam Chair, absolutely. We can get you the FTE assigned to each of those functions right away.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just go back to your previous question about the Title I dollars. Based on what we've seen in the last couple of cycles on the No Child Left Behind requirements on meeting adequate yearly progress, we're seeing that having that additional money for the Title I schools seems to be making a positive difference, and that we're seeing a higher percentage of our Title I schools make adequate yearly progress than the non-Title I schools. And so we are continuing to examine that data and find out why we're seeing higher rates of success there. But we believe that the additional funding is making a difference on helping those schools meet the needs of all kids.
Thank you. Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate their report card. There's some really interesting information in here. And I was looking on page 68 about the inflation-adjusted salaries, and I think it kind of runs counter to what the public's perception is out there, that the salaries for teachers have increased only 1.4%. in the 12-year period, and while superintendents have increased 14%. Is there any kind of, do you know, have any feeling for why the superintendent increase is as great as it is?
Madam Chair, Representative March, I'm sure our colleagues that are intending to present in a few moments from COSA could explain in great detail what's behind that. We are cautioned to let you know that the issue of new teachers coming into the system are much less expensive than teachers who have a great deal of experience, and that the pool of superintendents in the education community right now is very slim, and that it's a supply and demand issue largely. And I invite you to ask Mr. Hunsaker that same question.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your appearing here today, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And I will thank Ms. Fleming for her donation before she leaves. Well, we have, it looks like the Confederation of School Administrators or Administration come forward. Oh, you can bring it all the way up if you like.
You just don't leave money near those guys.
Thank you.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. With your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like to know if I could use the shorter term for our organization.
Now that you have spread it out, certainly feel free to
connect. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, COSA is an umbrella organization that represents a number of associations that represent school superintendents, elementary school principals, secondary school principals, as well as central office administrators. I would like to introduce some folks that are with me that you'll see either in front of the committee or in your offices individually. We've registered them with standards and practices, so they may be doing some lobbying. I'm joined at the witness table by Kent Hunsaker, who was our executive director. I'd also like to introduce Wilma Wells, who is our expert on special education, its own special piece of work, and Wilma will be representing us on all bills dealing with special education. And also Craig Hawkins, who is our new Director of Communications and may deal with some of the technology issues as well as assist us in trying to take some of the data we hear you asking for and data we develop and make it as useful as possible as we talk with you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've handed you a fairly substantial packet of information. We'd like to go over it with you. We're not going to take you into tremendous detail, let you take some time and go through this. We think, though, this will provide a kind of primer on some of the information that you'll be dealing with this session. You will hear us in front of this committee on a wide range of issues. We understand you are not an appropriations committee, and we're handing you a lot of budget data. We just would like to begin today telling you that one of the biggest issues that happens with what seem to be fairly innocuous policy changes or mandates or whatever is you start adding to our costs at the individual school district level. So you'll hear us talking about money. There seems to be no way to discuss issues of education without first discussing the various funding problems that we're facing at this point. The first three sheets are the three sheets I'm going to talk to you about for just a second. You'll notice the cover sheet refers to the governor's plan. The reason I'm providing this to you is just to give you a feel for how we see education funding in its simplest sense. And that is, if you look at 2003-2005 budget, K-12 received 44.7% of the general fund budget. In 2005-2007, that percentage is down to 42%. It's just a change in priorities in the governor's budget, and that priority is to decrease funding of K-12 education. It's just that simple. I mean, if you look at those percentages, it's a change in the way this is being viewed, and it's a concern to us. It represents ultimately an absolute difference in how we would do business if this budget were adopted directly. In that, if you look at the 42%, that's the $5.0 billion state school fund. If we had a continuing 44.7% of the state general fund, we would be at just in excess of 5.3, which is the roll up for our various fixed costs from the 2003-2005 budget, and we would be whole. So it's just a change in the way things were set into priority this session. The second two pages just give you a look at how those roll-ups work and how the cost to the state school fund increase. And the third page, summary of assumptions, I think is probably the most interesting page to use. It takes a look at the various cost drivers, primarily the cost drivers in the state school fund. I just want to mention we do show growth in average teacher salary, gross and cost of health benefits, PERS, et cetera. The numbers that I think are going to be most important during the session, and you'll hear the most about, are growth in the cost of health benefits. For every percent increase in the cost of health benefits in the K-12 system, it costs the system $19 million. And in the PERS system, each percent of increase in the PERS system costs us $40 million. So if the assumed rate of 15.09% for this next budget year does not occur, if in fact it's higher and appears at this point it could well be higher, for every percentage point it goes up, it's costing K-12 across the board $40 million. So the question of whether or not we are receiving adequate funding, what the number should be as we discuss funding throughout the session, remains problematic until we get a very clear picture on these, particularly these two fixed costs, health insurance as well as PERS.
Well, that's gloomy news.
What? I did it with a smile. I mean,
my glasses have
full. No, it is not. It is not particularly positive news, but it's just so as you look at things, you'll at least have reference points. That's what we're trying to make sure you have. Thanks.
Mr. Hunsaker?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kent Hunsaker, and I'm the 18-month experienced executive director for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I also would like to use the term COSA so that I won't have to put my dollar in the pot, but I probably, due to my inexperience, will probably say something, so I know I'm going to donate sooner or later. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk. I'd first like to address Representative March's question, if that's okay. Representative March, you You talked about the data that was there that showed that superintendent salaries had gone up 14% on average, while teachers hadn't gone up, I believe it was 1.8. A couple of things in terms of viewing that average that we would we think that's important for you to consider is that there's been a lot of change in people over the last period of years due to retirement system and PERS and a variety of things. And this, all this does is an average of the salaries that are out there. And when you look at that, one of the key things to keep in mind is that when you replace a superintendent, you replace them at pretty much the same salary. So when I left my job at Bethel that I'd been at for 16 years, the person that was brought in was brought in at a salary $2,000 less than me. If you want to take the Portland School District, for example, when that new salary was brought in, it was brought in probably at $50,000 or $60,000 higher than the salary that was already there. That happens very differently in the teaching ranks. So that when you lose a very experienced teacher, which are the ones that are leaving to go retire from the in PERS and so on, they are not replaced by a person of similar salary. So when their salaries are figured into the average, it has a tendency to keep those averages lower than you would see in the administrative ranks, where you don't have a 16-step salary schedule, but only have set salaries that are used. So that's the caution. I believe the data is very accurate. In other words, what's there are the exact average salaries that, that they have seen. But because of that calculation method, it probably wouldn't be accurate to say the superintendents have received 14% raises while teachers have received 2. I'd even expand further and say, I could say to you that when teachers receive raises, we know that they get steps and whatever cost of living adjustment there is. And it could be that an administrator might only get a salary increase. But keep in mind, the same principle applies. You have people that are very low salaried, and the only way they progress over a period of 16 years is to get steps and increases. So in those cases, where somebody might get a 6 or 7% increase on a $25,000 salary, that's very different. So it wouldn't be right to compare that either as a percentage because you're moving people up the scale. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Yeah, I think you pointed out very correctly that the teacher salaries are low, and that is an average of the state. And superintendents do cost about twice as much. And it's one of those costs, I think, that the public loses sight of. And they see the amount of money going out from the state to education. And, yes, I mean, one of the problems is we've gone from funding less than a third of the state's education picture to more than two-thirds. And we're not the driver of the costs. We don't control the costs. We don't set the salaries. We don't set any of those benefits. It's done at the local levels. So people have to look themselves in the eye and get involved in their local school boards. Thank you.
The next piece that you have in front of you is the it's in white. Yes.
We do have a salary schedule for superintendents and central office people. Could we look at one of those?
By a salary schedule, Representative Dalton, by a salary schedule, you're referring.
You do an annual survey of.
We do, and we have our annual survey. But what I was referring to before when I was talking about a salary schedule is that with teachers, quite often you'll see beginning teachers up to 12, 15 year salary schedules, whereas with a superintendent you wouldn't have a salary schedule. It is a single salary for a single person, and it varies differently. But we do have that, our survey, and could provide that.
Thank you.
The next piece that you have is in white. It's labeled at the top, State School Fund, SSF, State School Fund Projections for 05-07. I'd point out a couple of things in this. And what we are providing here is just information for you to be able to look at any district and see what their allocation is in terms of the of dollars under the governor's $5.0 billion. In the first page, at the very, the second from the bottom paragraph, you'll note that in these numbers are not the following things: the 11% cap waiver process, the small high school grants, the facility grants, and the high-cost disability grants. Some of those, obviously, those are the Senate Bill 550 funds, the small high school and the high-cost disability. The facility grants are for those $17 million that goes to districts that are building new facilities to help them open those facilities. And the 11% cap waivers are for districts with real high numbers of high-cost disability students, of special ed students. So those numbers are not in there. But this does provide you a look at any district that you choose to pick. I'm going to move you next to the blue page, which is a piece that I put together for the Medford School District. And this kind of tells its own story. It goes through and it looks at the year, the revenue, the number of students that they have, and the various factors of the state school fund formula that provide for an equalized amount per student for all districts. The thing that I wanted to point out as a part of this is, number one, I want you to look at, first of all, the 01-03 biennium and look at what happened in Medford. And by the way, I've done this for a lot of districts, and so the same thing applies, only on different scales for other districts. So in 01-02, the thing that you notice there is the $74.7 million that they received. The next year, how much less did they receive? About $5 million. Now take a look at the 03-05 biennium. In 03-05, in the first year of the biennium, 78. In the second year of the biennium, how much less? $6 million. Probably the biggest problem for superintendents in the last two sets of bienniums is what? They've given people money up front and taken away money in the second year. In almost every case, districts across this state have had to save money from the first year of the biennium so that they would have enough money to fund the second year of the biennium. It is totally different than has ever happened as you look back on the history of the way we've allocated money during the bienniums, which is the first year of the biennium you get a certain amount, and the second year you get more, enough to continue that same level of program. Right now, you may have even heard that there are districts running pretty high cash balances out there. Why are they doing that? Because if they weren't running those balances, they could not fund their program in 04-05, because they're using the cash that was left over from the higher funding year to fund the lower funding year. Something that has not happened as you look at the history of the state school fund. Medford's current
account. Are you asking then that we fund schools early and stabilize that figure so that
it,
you know?
It is a, Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, it is a very keen factor. We've talked about this with a variety of superintendents, and that the stability of the funding is a real tough thing for schools, and it is something to consider, that we make sure that as we provide funding, that the second year of the biennium will support some type of an increase in the first year. Normally that funding has been to allocate 49% of the money in the first year and about 51% in the second year. In higher inflation times, it might have been 46 and 54, or something like that, 47 and 53. But right now it's 49 and 51, and that provides the buffer. If you look at Medford on this chart, and I don't want you to find that one, but if you look at Medford, the number for Medford for 05-06 is $78,392,000. If you want to go up and compare that, that's exactly what they got in 03-04, almost exactly. So the funding that is being proposed for most districts across the state is the same amount of funding that they received 2 years ago, and with the governor's 5.0. I would be happy to provide a sheet like this for any district that you would like to see. The next piece of Yes.
Representative March?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The $4 million accrual, 0203, if I recall correctly, that was the fancy check work that we did in all the special sessions in which we actually rolled over the last payment into the next fiscal. And is that what bumped up the 0304 to 78?
No, Madam Chair, Representative March, the what brought 78 in 0304 is the fact that, if you recall, that $5.2 billion was allocated in 0305. And they went ahead and said, we're going to figure out what that would be on the split. We're going to give you that up front. And then when the money didn't come through, they said, you're going to take the full cut in the second year of the biennium. So that was ratcheted up, and it was actually funded in the first year like it was $5.2 billion. But it really turned out to be 4.9, so then it dropped down to $72 million. And again, if you look at any district, this same perspective would pretty much follow on a different scale as to their size.
Thank you.
The next piece of information is a very interesting one because there's a lot of conversation about what is the impact of growth or decline on a school district and what kinds of districts are really experiencing growth and decline. So this is a look at all of the school districts in the state over a period of the last 5 years and allows you to track their growth and decline. We'll take the top school district on here. The Portland School District in 99-2000 had 48,899 students. In 03-04, it had 45,357 students. That difference is 3,542 students. It's a drop of 8%. To put that in perspective, that would be a lot of money. If you take 5,000 times 3,500, that's $17.5 million in revenue that the Portland School District has lost because of their declining enrollment. One thing I would point out to that is that declining enrollment is very problematic for a lot of districts. I always looked at it like if you lost 25 students, 25 times $5,000 would be $125,000. You don't lose $125,000 worth of expenditures when you lose those students. You might be able to drop a teacher, and you might be able to drop a few supplies and materials. But that teacher salary and benefits and those supplies and materials will not be $125,000. They'll be probably less than half of that. So that means that the other cuts have to be absorbed in the system.
We have a question at this point. Can you accommodate that person?
Madam Chairman, would that drop in enrollment be more precipitous as a percentage if you were in a smaller school? You lose five students in a smaller school, the impact on the budget is disastrous. I think the small schools have been singing that song for a long time, haven't they?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, and in fact, we intend to show that here later on as we highlight several districts that are in different categories. Portland's 8% is dwarfed by, we have some small school districts here with 30% drop in enrollment over that same period of time. We also have some small school districts with a 44% increase in enrollment over that period of time. This only allows you to go through and see if you're interested in districts, but there's a couple of questions out there. One would be, if you were to think about the two highest, the fastest growing districts in this state that are over 3,000 students, what might those districts be? The answer might surprise you. That the fastest growing district in this state, according to this data, is Sherwood School District. 26.7% increase over the last 5 years. The next fastest growing school district in the state is Woodburn. And that was very surprising to me that Woodburn would be in that category. Obviously, you think of Beaverton and Hillsboro and some of these districts. The largest district in the top 10, say, with the fastest growing enrollment is David Douglas, 15 and a half during this period of time. But you can go through and see what the changes are. In the, you know, if you turn the page and you look at the big declines on the next page, I went through and highlighted those. North Bend, 15% decline in over that five-year period. Pleasant Hill, 16% decline over that period. And John Day over in Eastern Oregon, 18% decline over that period. On the next page, there's a whole bunch of 25% declines over that period. But the data is here for you to look at. And Representative Dahlem's point about small schools is really the case. And I'll highlight one on the last page. It is the Alsea School District. They had 221 kids and 99,000. And by the way, it's down about 10 on the very last page. And they have 156 kids currently. That's a loss of 65 students in that district. A loss in percentage of students of 30%. And, you know, what is Alsea? Alsea has their own story, I guarantee you, about what funding means to them as they deal with not only the state funding, but dealing with this issue of losing 30% of your enrollment. So it's a real key. The last piece of data that we have provided for you is, we think, one of the most interesting ones, because it analyzes the way school districts spend. And you're going to see a variety of information about, and there has been some criticism of the way school districts spend. The first chart that you have there is a pie chart that lays out the percentages for instruction. And you'll notice that that percentage is 59.5 in the pie chart. The average across this state is 59.5%. towards instruction. And then it takes all the areas of support services and says what the percentages are that are allocated to those. So you can see that media centers are about 3.5% of that. The areas of counseling, nurses, and speech are about 5.7% of that. And by the way, there are some that would believe that those are direct services, the very direct services to kids, and actually fit in the instructional area, because how do you think of a media center and kids going to the library as not being a part of instruction and reading books and so on? The work that happens in speech and helping students with speech disabilities and so on is not being instruction. But it is viewed as a support service, so in a lot of ways, the first thing I wanted to point out is that some people have viewed that other 40% being overhead, administration. And as you look at this chart, we've broken down administration so you can see what those costs are. General administration, which would be the central offices across the state, and all the support structures that go in those, at 1.3% of the budget. And school building administrators at 6.8% of the budget. Business services and that whole area that monitors the spending and so on in the district at 1.8. And then you can see the operations and maintenance and custodial services at 8.7, taking care of your buildings and so on. And transportation and food services and the other components. So you can see them broken out in a way. The yellow sheets and the green sheets and the gray sheets is to take every district and break instruction and support services down so you can see exactly what they spend and compare. We actually provided this to every school district in the state. And it used the database initiative, which is also known as... Find a dollar if I say DBI?
No, you explained it. That's
okay.
Fine. Perfect.
which supposedly says that everybody takes their data and puts it in the same way. And unfortunately, that doesn't occur, and so some of the things can be explained in here, the big differences can be explained. I'm going to direct you to the yellow sheet, and I would like you to go down to the Tigard School District on the yellow sheet. If you'll notice that the Tigard School District has their percentage for instruction is 52%. And you look at that, and you look at that in relation to every district on there, and you say to yourself, well, that's odd, right? That the Tigard School District would spend 52 when most people are spending 60? What's the answer for that? Well, I went to the Tigard superintendent and I said, tell me what the answer is. And the answer is that Tigard has a SCRIPT program in their district. If you're not familiar with SCRIPT program, it's where community members buy SCRIPT. They go out into the stores and they spend the SCRIPT, and the district gets a percentage of that. The SCRIPT program in Tigard brings in about $3.5 million. They run it through their support services program, and it makes their support services look really big. But it's kind of an in-and-out budget item. And so you take out their SCRIPT program, they come into line with everybody else. I think they're right at 62%. So there are answers to some of the variables that you would see here. But it shows every district in the state in the breakdown. And we've actually asked districts to look at their data. This is the audited data for 02-03 and say, is there any things, is this data right, and to really look at it. We've also grouped it by district by size so they can go through and look at it and say, well, gosh, how is some district able to spend so much more money on elementary instruction than we do? Or how are they able to hold their costs down in an area that we're really interested in? So it allows you to look at the spending patterns of districts across the state. And we are, like I say, we're using it to provide information to our districts. We're using it to provide information to you to show how schools are spending money. Be happy to answer any questions you have about it.
Thank you. One notation. You did reference this was drawn from the Database Initiative, also known as DBI. And the most recent audited information that is currently available is 2002-2003. So there is somewhat of a lag for current assessments.
Madam Chair, that is correct, and that's a part of the problem with the audited data. They've just got in the audited data from 03-04, and they have not brought that together to be able to create something new here. So we'll be able to compare new data probably within a couple of months.
That would be right. Expedient.
Yeah.
Probably on normal timetable. Representative Stone.
Yes, Madam Chairman. On the in the column, middle school extracurricular and high school extracurricular. What number? What went into making up those numbers? Green sheet.
Green sheet. The under regular programs.
Yes.
Representative Dolan, the question has to do with middle school and high school. Extracurricular programs, those would be activity programs for students in various areas of government, clubs, and also all athletic activities. So activities and athletics at both the middle school and high school.
More specifically, that would be coaches and advisors' salaries.
That's correct.
We'll take one last question because I know we're going to invite our friends back as we move forward. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talking about the growth in the Woodburn School District, are the schools within correctional facilities considered part of these numbers?
Madam Chair, Representative Shields, I don't believe so, but I don't know that I really know the answer to that question, and I think that if they're in school, if they're in the Woodburn schools, they would be, but I don't believe that they're included if they're not being serviced by the Woodburn schools, but I probably need to check on that.
Are not Oregon Youth Authority schools a separate line item?
They are.
I'm seeing a lot of nods.
Madam Chair, in fact, on the attendance chart, you see the Oregon Youth Authority enrollment there, but I think I also believe the question applies that, you know, do correctional facilities bring enrollment to districts actually when there's a correctional facility also and that was being planned in Junction City? So we're trying to look at the impact that that correctional facility could have, and we looked at some studies from Washington and California where they did predict that they would bring quite a bit of enrollment to a school district. But if you're talking about students that are in that, in the correctional facility, I don't believe that they're included in Woodburn's attendance data.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes. Well, then we'll take one last question, Representative Lim.
It's not a question concerning the Woodburn area. That the growth comes from the mostly Hispanics. And if you go in that area, you can find a lot of Hispanics moving into that area, farming area. There's tremendous growth in that area. So that's one of the factors fastest growing in the school district.
Thank you. I think that is good. Gentlemen, thank you so very much. And I know we will be seeing you further.
We look forward to working with you.
And to wrap up our session today, John Marshall with the Oregon School Board Association, also known as OSB. OSBA, there it is for you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I plan on being uncharacteristically brief this afternoon given the time, as well as the fact that I don't want to wear out my welcome here only on the first day of your second week. I've distributed for you a packet of information that I think will give you a pretty good sense of some of the programs and services that OSB offers to its constituent school districts. Much of what we do, in fact, of most of what we do, occurs outside this building, and that is to try to assist locally elected board members do their job as best as they possibly can. We have a great deal in common with you folks. I represent elected officials just like you are. And those elected officials are sitting around rooms somewhat like this, although perhaps not as elaborate, trying to deal with pressures from their constituents and certainly trying to allocate limited resources amongst some very competing and valuable needs in their communities. I'd like to share a little bit what we view as your role in fulfilling your constitutional duty to provide for a uniform and general system of common schools. As has been mentioned, and as I'm sure you know, the state's now providing 70% of school funding, K-12 school funding. Before Measure 5, it only provided 25 to 30%. Through the state school fund distribution formula, you're probably controlling probably 90% of school district financial resources. And although you're providing the bulk of the funds, we would like to encourage you not to view your role as a 90-member school board that meets in Salem every 2 years. You certainly have a legitimate right and a responsibility to set expectations, requirements, and standards to assure uniformity throughout Oregon's public school system as the Constitution dictates that you do. But we would encourage you that while you have a legitimate right and responsibility to determine the what of our public education system, that you leave the how to those locally elected officials that you've charged with setting local priorities based on local needs and circumstances. Certainly one of the big issues facing this legislature will be the question of K-12 funding. And we are certainly aware, as you are, of the financial realities we face. We're confident that when all said and done, K-12 will get its appropriate share of the pie. While we hope the pie would grow bigger, quicker, we realize that it's going to be based on our economy and its growth. But I would also encourage you not to forget the fact that our economy is based on the quality of our education system, not only K-12, but certainly community colleges and higher ed. Over the course of the next several months, we will try to share with you what we're doing, what we can do, what we should be doing, what we could be doing better, and finally what we can't do as we get into the financial picture. And a discussion of what that means. there's been a great deal of discussion about efficiencies and helping school districts be more efficient. There was a lot of rhetoric during the campaigns about send me to Salem and I'll direct more money to the classroom. And while those are worthy goals and we want to help you do that, I think what we first need to do is agree on definitions, agree on those components of school district spending that actually go to the classroom or support the classroom. Let's not look at various numbers and percentages without all agreeing first on what those numbers and percentages mean. Then I think we ought to identify and eliminate barriers to moving more money over to that instructional or classroom side versus the non-instructional or support services side. And we have some ideas to help you do that. There are those that have ideas to help elementary secondary schools, and many of those ideas will impose new requirements. And we will appear before you urging you to resist those new requirements. And we'll ask you to do a cost benefit. While many of these additional requirements may have a benefit out the other end, they also have costs going in the front end. And so we want you to very carefully weigh those and make determinations about, is this an appropriate time to impose additional requirements on the school districts? And if so, what should those requirements be? And finally, there's been a great deal of discussion about ESDs and the governor, the state superintendent of public instruction, and many of you would like to bring ESDs before your committee to review. I know of no institution in elementary secondary education that's been more studied than our education service districts. I think I owe my apologies. We believe that you have to start off with the assumption that there's a certain value in providing educational services on a regional basis. I don't think our structure of education service districts would exist if there weren't that shared value. But we believe the discussion has to begin by a discussion of what do you believe, what do we believe, what do we all believe the appropriate role and responsibility of education service districts ought to be. Once we can agree on that, then we can look at the 20 ESDs that currently exist and determine whether or not each has the capacity to fulfill those roles and responsibilities. And if they don't, then we can look at reorganization. But I would encourage you not to jump onto the reorganization bandwagon just for reorganization's sake, but to look at their role vis-a-vis not only their local school districts, but also some anticipated expectations on them that the Department of Education might have. I look forward to working with you, and I want to introduce, hopefully in the back room, Jim Green, and David Williams from our staff. We try to separate issues and create sort of expertise in various issues, and we look forward to helping you. If any of you need any help on understanding the background of various issues that are before this legislature have been around in the past, I would encourage you to call on us. We stand ready to help you, and we look forward to the point at which the sine die gavel will fall and we can look back on the 05 legislative session and said we did good. With that, Madam Chair, I'm finished.
Well, I am very impressed indeed. Are there questions for Mr. Marshall? Well, see, what a just a stellar job you did indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. As it had appeared that we were going to be running short of time, and we have arranged to reschedule the presentation from the Teachers' Standards and Practices Commission. So, since this was informational, and our information has been presented, no questions or comments, this Education Committee will stand adjourned.